Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host, and it's Friday, October 25th, 2013. Oh, you know, I hope you were with me last week. I'd be put into lordosis if I had to shoulder the burden of knowing that you had missed Giving Tuesday. Rachel Hutchison with Blackboard and Anastasia Delaccio from the United Nations Foundation shared the history of Giving Tuesday and how easy it is for your nonprofit to get involved with this international movement on December 3rd, 2013. And new low Facebook reach? Has your Facebook page reach plummeted? Amy Sample Ward, our social media contributor and the CEO of the Nonprofit Technology Network, N10, explained what's going on in Facebook and what you can do about it. She also shared her 60-second style stop, and it was a good one. This week, Dr. Seuss stories. What can green eggs and ham teach you about digital storytelling? Kelly Jarrett with Blackboard has tips for each step of the story arc and lots of great storytelling examples. She'll bring you to a resolution, a better state. That was recorded at BBCon this year. Also, fraud protection. Melanie Morton, manager of Blackboard Forms, explains where you may be vulnerable and how to limit your liability for nefarious deeds like check fraud, also recorded at BBCon this year. Between the guests on Tony's Take Two, I'll crush a planned giving myth. We're sponsored this week by Rallybound, software for runs, walks, and rides at rallybound.com. My pleasure now to bring you Dr. Seuss stories and digital storytelling.
Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of BBCon 2013 at the Gaylord Convention Center outside Washington, D.C. My guest is Kelly Jarrett. She's an employee of Blackboard. She is business development manager. Her topic, very interesting, very curious. Dr. Seuss helps you rock digital storytelling. Kelly Jarrett, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tony. Good to be here.
Dr. Seuss, is nothing sacred in this digital storytelling world?
That's a good question, yeah. I mean, he taught us a lot, that's for sure, about how we can use storytelling in everyday life, yeah.
Okay. Let's begin. What lessons can we learn from the good doctor?
So I talk a little bit about storytelling in general as kind of a story arc. So if you think about it, every story ever told really has a similar theory behind it, and that is it follows the same story arc where there is an introduction, a conflict that is introduced, a climax, and then a resolution. And Dr. Seuss, for example, if you think about Green Eggs and Ham, you have a character who is sort of boring and run-of-the-mill and sits around and reads the newspaper and is introduced with conflict through someone offering him something he's never seen before, and he decides he doesn't like it without even trying it, and that's, of course, the Green Eggs and Ham. And the climax is when he actually says, okay, I'm going to take a minute and actually try it and see what I think, and tastes the green eggs and ham and is put into a new state, which is the resolution of the story. And he likes it. He's a little more adventurous and kind of takes that leap into a new state of affairs for him and his life. So the idea here is that, you know, storytelling is a part of everyday life. Strong, good stories are told and retold over and over again, and typically will follow the same arc.
Did this occur to you when you were telling this story to someone?
Yeah, so I have two children, a four-year-old and a six-year-old, and that's exactly what happened. So I was doing a little research about brand storytelling, which is what I'm passionate about, web strategy and brand storytelling. I work with a team of creative designers, and they do web design and brand storytelling themselves. So the idea occurred to me when I was reading stories that I read as a child, kind of retelling those, and I knew the story, and it made me feel good when there was resolution at the end. And those are the stories that I enjoy and retell to my children. So that's exactly the idea. And it occurred to me that it's something that people respond to, and it really engages people when there's a good story with a strong story arc. So I started thinking how that could essentially translate into a nonprofit brand and their story, because as we know, nonprofit stories are their mission and how they serve their mission. So it was really kind of a neat idea and concept that I did a lot of research on and found the connection and was able to kind of tell it through the eyes of Dr. Seuss.
What other stories might be out there, with Dr. Seuss or otherwise, that were important in your research, this critical research you were doing?
So we started with, you know, books and stories, Argo for one, which is an actual story that happened in real life, where you have, you know, an introduction and a status quo and understanding kind of what the state of affairs is abroad.
That was around the taking of the hostages in Iran and the movie.
That's exactly right. So obvious conflict was introduced, and then, you know, the climax occurred when they were brought home and resolution. And every story that I researched, from storybooks to Disney characters and stories to Dr. Seuss and all of his books, to translate it into the idea of thinking through storytelling as a brand. And the first one I thought of was, of course, Apple, which has a great story. So Steve Jobs is kind of the lead character. And if you think about Steve and as he relates to Apple, it's sort of they tell a story of interesting people, right? They sort of created this story around their brand that makes you think Apple is cooler than it might actually be because of the story that they tell. So once I started thinking in terms of brands, you know, I looked into nonprofits and thought, well, how are they kind of telling their mission stories through this idea of the arc, introduction, conflict, climax, and resolution? And there's a nonprofit that does it really well, Charity Water. And the reason I use them in my session and kind of talk about them a lot is they keep a very, very focused approach to their story. So what they do is they provide water to those who don't have clean water.
They're
right?
at charitywater.org.
Yes, right? Exactly right. Wonderful organization. But what's especially wonderful about them is they tell their story very succinctly and never lose focus. Even through all of their social media efforts, all of their digital efforts, everything that they do from a marketing and advertising and outreach perspective all relates back to the single story that they have created for themselves. So even extending that through campaigns and things that they've done with their birthday campaign, which I can certainly talk more about, still relates back to their story, which is the introduction. They introduce characters, people that they have helped and served fresh, clean water to, the areas that they are serving, and they talk about the current state of affairs and how difficult it is for these people to find clean water, and you know what will happen and if they don't have access to clean water. And then the conflict is introduced with showing actual water that has, you know, really bad stuff in it, right? Yeah. A lot of bacteria and things that can make children very sick. So they follow this character through all of the stages. And at the time of, you know, thinking about how this story will come to climax, you think about how can you engage your users and audiences to help in the effort to bring clean water to this person. And what they've done really well is inspired their users to give or volunteer or fundraise on their behalf and almost become heroes in their story, which is the idea of translating storytelling to a nonprofit brand. How do you make your audience feel like the hero in your story by allowing them to get you to a new state or a resolution? And that's what Charity Water really does really well. So I tried to, you know, talk a little bit about that in a session I did here at BBCon, where, you know, introducing the idea that if you keep focus on your story and your mission and explain to people how they can help serve that mission, they're going to feel more engaged and more compelled to be involved in your organization.
Charity Water uses a lot of video. Do you think that's essential in good storytelling, or can we do a newsletter or a direct mail letter?
So I think, you know, I think multi-channel is key. I think everyone sees information differently and responds to different types of media differently. But to answer your specific question, video is absolutely an essential part of storytelling because it has all of the visual and audible cues that you need to connect with someone, right? So it's hard to just look at someone and have a connection. Talking brings more of a connection. So when you combine the two, you have video and you're able to put that on the website and it really does engage the user more. There is even a statistic that 57% of people who view a YouTube video from a nonprofit will actually donate, which is a huge amount.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's a... Oh. So it's compelling because it brings people into the story by using multiple cues, and I think video is a great way to do that.
And you mentioned multi-channel engagement, so you can have direct mail that drives you to a fuller story in video on the website. Same thing with email. You want to say more about the multi-channel storytelling?
Absolutely. So, and what I usually typically talk about is there are so many ways to connect with your users. The one thing you have to remember is even if you use all of these channels, you have to have a consistent message. So it has to be saying the same thing. So if you have a direct mail piece, it should support your website. It should support the videos. It should all have the same message, because I think, you know, we can all agree that sometimes we have to hear things a couple of times in order for it to sort of sink in and get what we're trying to do. It's no different for nonprofit users. So it's important to remember that, you know, multi-channel is important because it's reinforcing that message. It's providing consistency, and it's reinforcing the message that you're trying to get across. And that message is your story.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Do you need a business plan that can guide your company's growth? Covenant 7 will help bring the changes you need. We are small business consultants, and we pay attention to the details you may miss. Our coaching and consultant services are guaranteed to lead to right growth for your business. Call us at 917-833-4860 for a no-obligation free consultation. Check out our website at www.covenant7.com.
Are you fed up with talking points rhetoric? Every way you turn, it's left or right spin, ideology, no reality. In fact, it's ideology over intellect. No more. It's time for the truth. Join me, Larry Sharp, a.k.a. The Neo-Sage, Tuesday nights, 9 to 11 Eastern, for the Ivory Tower radio program. In the Ivory Tower, we'll discuss what's important to you, society, politics, business, and family. It's provocative talk for the realist and the skeptic who want to know what's really going on, what does it mean, and what can be done about it. So gain special access to the Ivory Tower and listen to me, Larry Sharp, your Neo-Sage, Tuesday nights, 9 to 11, New York time. Go to ivorytowerradio.com for details. That's ivorytowerradio.com. The Ivory Tower is a great place to visit for both entertainment and education. Listen in, Tuesday nights, 9 to 11. It will make you smarter.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com. Talking Alternative.
Do you have specific advice around the introduction, the conflict, the climax, and the resolution?
Yeah, so I think it's a neat exercise to sit down and think through the story arc for your organization. Think through, you know, introduction. What is the status quo? What is happening right now, which is a problem.
It's a problem in our world and or in our town or whatever. Yeah,
that's exactly right. And as nonprofits, we're solving problems.
Now, how do you put a face to that? You know, sometimes statistics can be maybe numbing or maybe so overwhelming that they drive someone to inaction, or at least that's the fear. How do you, I guess, maybe I'm answering my own question, but you can say a lot more about it, personalize this so that the person feels they can actually have an impact on this problem that may be enormous?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to personalize it. And that is by creating characters for your nonprofit. And characters can come in a lot of different ways. You can have, you know, characters that are part of your organization. So a lot of times, like if we think about the Wreaths Across America story, the founder is really their main character. She tells the story. She's clearly very passionate about it. She gets emotional as she speaks about, you know, what the organization actually does. And it's a powerful thing. And she's become a key character in their story. So you can use people that are part of the organization.
Let me just interrupt. Sure. Kelly is talking about Karen Worcester, who's executive director of Wreaths Across America. And we'll have been on the show, or will be very soon, because I interviewed her earlier this morning at BBCon.
Great.
Please.
Absolutely.
She does get very emotional, and actually made me very emotional when I asked her what it is that she loves about the work. And she talked about a mom laying a wreath, and Karen was with her, and what that wreath meant to the memory of her son, of the woman's son. It's very touching.
It's a compelling story, and characters don't have to necessarily come from within the organization. You can actually have people that your mission has impacted tell your story, and they become essentially characters of your story as well. So who have you helped? How have you helped them? What is their story? And let them tell it. And essentially, they become part of the story, talking about how you've affected their lives, right? So we talked about this a little bit in my session, and there were some great ideas from nonprofits out there, because it's a little hard. If you're a cancer research foundation, for example, who are your characters? What is your story? Yeah. Because there's a lot that research goes towards. And you know, it might be as simple as finding, you know, who are those researchers and talk about what they do every day to end cancer, or pick a couple of funding priorities and talk about those stories and the people involved in those and those impacted by that particular thing that you're funding at the moment. So there's a lot of different ways to do it, but doing it is the key.
Maybe researcher as hero.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And that's a great way to say
perhaps.
It. You got it.
Okay. So that's our introduction.
Mm-hmm.
What's your advice around conflict in the arc?
So, you know, conflict should be introduced, because clearly there are conflicts preventing us from serving our missions. So what is that conflict? And it's important to tell people, you know, what is the conflict that is preventing us from fulfilling our mission? Or what is the conflict that is preventing our heroes or our characters to be in a place of good? So with the Charity Water example, you know, they introduce a young man named John Bosco, who lives in a third world country, has no access to clean water. And they talk about him, and they introduce him, and they show him walking, you know, 10 miles every day just to get access for a little bit of water for his family, and his mother holding it on her back and walking miles and miles. And it's very difficult, and that's the conflict, no access to clean water. So there are a lot of different ways to do it. We work with a local organization in Charleston who has a lot of different conflicts, because they are an organization that supports conservancy of the land in our area. So there are a lot of different things that can be talked about as conflicts. And the nice thing that they do is pull those in and talk about them.
Development, industry,
absolutely,
zoning, it could be government, it could be corporate.
That's exactly right.
It could be, I don't know, individuals who want other uses than conservation.
You got it. So the most recent story is cruise ships that are coming into the Charleston area.
Excellent.
And it's very controversial. And, you know, their idea is to educate and talk about, you know, how is it affecting our coastline and what is it doing? And they talk about that story. And then they say, here's how you can help. And the resolution side is they say, if you do help, here's what will happen. If you don't, here's what will happen, right? So are you going to put the coastline in a new state, or are we going to see it continue to deteriorate? And that's their story as an organization.
Yeah. Okay. Is there another example before we continue on our arc? Another example you'd like to share? You probably have a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, I do have
plenty for
conflict. But that's exactly right. And then, of course, you know, at the climax part of the story is really where you're getting the user involved.
Oh, wait, I want to hear more conflict stories.
Oh, more conflict stories.
Yeah. Give us another good storytelling conflict.
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. So let's see. I mean, it could be as simple. I mean, it doesn't have to be life or death.
But in a
hospital foundation, for example, you can talk about the families who are struggling to, you know, either pay for this care, or they're going through with a disease, a family member with a disease that they simply don't have access to. And it might be an organization like, let's say, the ARC, for example, which is a wonderful organization who supports all types of disabilities, their families, educators, et cetera. And by introducing that the problem is related not to the diagnosis, but to communication and education, that's their conflict. If people don't know about this, there's not going to be research to solve this problem, right? So those are the types of things that can be introduced at as conflict, depending on your story.
Okay. Let's talk about climax, mm-hmm. some ideas around there.
Yeah. So this is my favorite part, obviously, because it gives the user or the audience a chance to help. And that's what you're really trying to do with the introduction and the conflict. You're setting the stage for someone to feel like they want to help or need to help, right? So if you've done a good job telling your story so far, you have an introduction, the status quo, you've introduced conflict, and someone is feeling compelled to do something, and they feel connected to the mission, they feel connected to the nonprofit, they want to help. And that is the goal of the first part of the story. The climax is really letting them help, and it can be as simple as donating, right? So one thing that we typically recommend is obviously tell your story and then give the user, and let's just say this is online because we were talking digital storytelling.
Okay.
Give the user the background and have and provide an avenue for them to help, whether that's to fundraise, if you have a peer-to-peer strategy and they are going to fundraise on your behalf as an organization, or donate directly. Those are two obvious ways from a fundraising perspective to help, but there are other ways. Volunteer, sign up for an event, tell them what to do that will help impact the mission and sort of get to a new state in a resolution of your story.
Okay. You have an example of a good use of climax?
Yeah, so if we're following the Charity Water story, they do a really nice job cleanly. They have three ways that you can help. And once they've told their story, they show all of the background and they introduce the conflict and they tell all the characters' stories. And then they say, fundraise. And you can fundraise using a peer-to-peer tool, fundraise, and basically retell their story to your friends and family to get them involved. You can donate directly. But the other sort of benefit to or good thing that they do is they don't just say give to our organization. They say provide clean water for a whole community, provide clean water for a family.
Oh, at different levels of giving.
And those are the different levels of giving. Yeah. So they really put a tangible to it, and that is a nice way to tie the story to the gift and have someone feel like they're really doing something for the mission.
And the gift to the impact.
Exactly.
It's a family, it's a community, it's a new truck, a new well.
You got it. And it doesn't always have to be financial. It doesn't have to be donations necessarily. That's an obvious one. But there are other opportunities. I was giving the example, Coastal Conservation League in Charleston. This is an organization who is a strong advocacy organization. So in their case, their action that they were requesting or their climax was to take action, to send a letter to local representatives, to get involved, you know, in some way, to tell.
Write letters to the editors of newspapers.
Editors of newspapers, our, you know, senators, anyone who has a stake or, you know, is not only impacted by what's going on, but can help solve the problem. The mayor, whatever the case is, depending on the conflict that they've introduced. So the idea is, you know, giving options to be involved. In this morning session, I have a few ideas, but a lot of them came from the groups that were there.
Share a couple.
Fantastic, because one organization, and unfortunately I can't remember the name, but they are a foster care organization, and of course they are hoping to find foster families to keep these children. However, they were trying to get others involved who can't necessarily take on a child, don't have, you know, what for whatever reason, they're not in the right age group, they can't take on a child physically, they are not able to commit to that. But they were trying to find another avenue to help, and what they did was allow for a fundraising program that goes to funding a child's birthday. So a foster child's birthday, saying give them a great birthday and also give to this organization. So what the organization did was they raised money that went to the organization, but they did provide to this child, this foster child, a wonderful birthday. And as someone, you know, who maybe is just out of college, wants to get involved, can't necessarily take on a foster child, it gives them a chance to be involved in this wonderful organization and really make an impact in their story.
We should go to the final part of our arc, the resolution.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So ideally the resolution should put you know, the hero, as well as the characters in a new state, and it should be a better state, right? So if you've done your job, you know, if the hero has done their job, what will happen? Will the coastline be protected for one more year or against cruise ships if that's the issue at hand? What are those things that you can actually impact? And the resolution shows online, ideally, you know, how was that resolved? And it's not always, of course, we called it in our session the never-ending story, because it's not like you can solve all of the problems related to your mission. Otherwise, we wouldn't have nonprofits that are, continually raise money and do wonderful things. But what it allows you to do is show the successes, show what you've done, provide avenues to show how have you helped people involved in your mission, whatever that is. How many meals have you served? How many animals have you saved? How many, what coastline did you preserve from getting polluted? Whatever your issue is as a nonprofit, showcase online the resolution. What have you done, and what did the donors' dollars do? It's essentially stewardship, right? It's essentially showing stewardship online.
And showing impact. Which is so critical now, and so much talk about that.
Absolutely.
Storytelling, you're calling it resolution.
Yes.
But it's...
It's impact.
Showing the impact.
You got
okay.
it.
Okay.
Yep.
We have a couple more minutes left. What would you like to share that I haven't asked you about or hasn't come out?
Yeah, so I would say, I mean, there's sort of a second part of this. Once you have your story down...
We don't have 25 minutes left.
Yeah, so, that's okay.
So I hope the second part is shorter than the first.
The second part is very short.
Okay.
So the storytelling is the most important part. However, it's important to remember that you can extend your story, and the idea of getting your story retold is this whole idea of social media and campaigns and how can you kind of further your story and get others to share your story. I think that what I would say, if I had to sort of hone it down into a couple of points here, is to make sure your story is strong and people are compelled to retell it. So social media is a great way to do that. How can you encourage folks to share your story on Twitter? How can you encourage people to fundraise on your behalf? One perfect example of this, and it's probably good to end on, is the Charity Water example of the birthday campaign. So we talked about their story, and it's a very powerful one. They created a campaign where someone could, instead of asking for presents for their birthday or expecting presents for their birthday, fundraise and say, rather than doing that, for my 20th birthday, give $20 to Charity Water, and here's what, you know, all of the wonderful things that they do. And they give them an avenue to tell their story online, where they can write a little blurb about how Charity Water has impacted their life or why do they care.
So they're making it very easy to share also.
You got it.
Not only encouraging the sharing, but making it very easy.
And that's a very good point.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. So. And they do that. And then not only do they encourage folks to share, make it easy to share, they also have the opportunity to further share it. Share it with my friends and family, link back, and have the opportunity to continue the story on and on. And that's where, you know, if you think about viral marketing, that's sort of the essence of it. It's the idea that your story will be retold and retold time and time again.
Kelly, what is it that you love about this work around storytelling?
Well,
I can tell it really moves you.
It does. I'm passionate about it because I feel like, you know, nonprofits really have strong stories. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing what they do. It's all about the story that they're trying to tell. And so what I like about my work with nonprofits and kind of talking through some of this is giving them the chance to focus on telling their story in a very clear and compelling way. Sometimes nonprofits get so excited about all the wonderful things they're doing, they forget their core and their story that they're trying to keep it to. And so this idea of kind of, you know, refining your story down to the simplest terms to make it clear to your constituents and those who you're talking with is very important because it keeps the focus on what you're trying to do, which is serve your mission.
Kelly Jarrett is Business Development Manager at Blackbaud. Our topic was Dr. Seuss Helps You Rock Digital Storytelling. Kelly, thanks very much for sharing your advice.
Thank you, Tony.
It's a pleasure. It's Tony Martinetti, Nonprofit Radio coverage of BBCon 2013. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks very much to everyone at BBCon. That was a very fun day. September 30th of this year. Stay with me. Coming up after this break, Tony's Take Two, crush a plan giving myth, and then fraud protection. Hang in there.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
Hi, I'm Austin Marola.
And I'm Sloan Wainwright.
We're the hosts of the new Thursday morning show, The Music
Power Hour.
At 11 a.m.
We're going to have fun.
And shine the light on all aspects of music.
And its limitless healing possibilities.
We're going to invite artists to share their songs and play live.
We'll be listening and talking about great music from yesterday to today.
So you're invited to share in our musical conversation.
Your ears will be delighted with the sound of music.
And our voices. Join Austin
and Sloan
live Thursdays at 11 a.m. on TalkingAlternative.com.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
If you have big ideas but an average budget, tune into Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio for ideas you can use. I do. I'm Dr. Robert Penna, author of the Nonprofit Outcomes Toolbox.
Hi there. Welcome back. Can't do live listener love this week because we're not live. I'm in the studio a few days in advance, but I certainly want to send love to everybody who is listening live. I just don't know where you are exactly. And special shout out to all our Asian listeners, routinely listeners from Japan, China, and South Korea. So I wish you konnichiwa, ni hao, and anyo hasayo. Tony's Take Two. My blog this week is Don't Believe This Planned Giving Myth. The myth is we have planned giving covered. I hear it from CEOs, head fundraisers, and board members. They believe that because someone has planned giving in their job title, that the organization is doing all it can to promote and market planned giving. And the reality is that whatever job gets paired with planned giving will have much more immediate deadlines and quicker payoff to the nonprofit than planned giving ever will. So planned giving gets shortchanged. For instance, have you seen the title Director of Annual and Planned Giving? I have seen that one a few times, and it's a very unfortunate pairing for someone because annual giving has monthly production goals. And in the fourth quarter, very likely has weekly production goals. Planned giving cannot compete with that demand for the fundraiser's attention. So in that case, planned giving may be half the title, but it's getting much less than half the fundraiser's time. I think average is like 10% or so of their time. Planned giving just always gets short shrift when it's paired with some other fundraising responsibility. So I urge you to not deceive yourself thinking that planned giving is covered just because it's in someone's title. There's more about that on my blog at tonymartinetti.com. The blog post is called Don't Believe This Planned Giving Myth. And that is Tony's Take Two for Friday, 25th of October, the 42nd show of the year. have for you now a BBCon interview, Fraud Protection.
Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of BBCon 2013. We're outside Washington, D.C. in National Harbor, Maryland at the Gaylord Convention Center. My guest is Melanie Morton. She is with Blackbaud, and she's manager of Blackbaud Forms. Melanie Morton, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tony. It's great to be here.
It's a pleasure. Glad you were able to just talk about a topic that doesn't get a lot of attention, fraud protection. What are some of the vulnerabilities that small and mid-sized nonprofits, those are our listeners, have?
Well, when you look at surveys on payments fraud done by finance professionals and fraud examiners, as well as the Federal Trade Board, Reserve Board, excuse me, the biggest vulnerabilities are experienced by smaller organizations.
Oh, okay.
They have fewer controls. They have more instances of fraud, and when fraud occurs in their organizations, it occurs at a much higher rate, so it's much more expensive for them. So in my role, part of my job has been to sort of become aware of what those vulnerabilities are, and to do a little campaign to make people focus better on what their fraud protections are. We do have some products that have fraud protection involved in it. But more importantly, it's really about putting the internal controls in place to protect themselves.
Okay, let's talk in detail then. What's the most alarming vulnerability that small and mid-sized shops should be aware of?
Well, types of payment fraud that are out there. Check fraud is the most prevalent and the most expensive. So it's really, really important for organizations to think about how to minimize their vulnerability to that. That starts with having great controls in place. First of which, making sure that they've clearly documented internal controls. So you define your standards and you train your staff on how you expect your accounting system and your payment process to go.
Okay.
A second one is having an employee tip line so that people can report fraud easily. Organizations that have a tip line in place or a hotline for their employees see a much lower rate of fraud.
Now, how would a small organization have a tip line? Okay, so look to your outside auditor.
Exactly.
For that.
Okay. Exactly.
Or a board member, or the if you have an audit committee of the board.
Definitely.
They could look to that.
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay.
And then, interestingly, the third most effective procedure for preventing fraud is the use of internal audits, both the planned ones and surprise ones, because you want your staff to be aware that you're paying attention. And what's most concerning about those really effective procedural controls is that they're extremely cheap to implement. And the worst controls, the ones that most organizations think are effective, are the use of external audits. While they're required, they're actually not particularly effective in preventing fraud.
Oh, so the annual required audit is not very good?
Yeah. These guys aren't magicians.
That generally accepted accounting principles statement is not going to be very reliable in terms of fraud detection?
Exactly. And all you have to do is Google payments fraud surveys, and every single one put out there in the industry and by regulatory agencies will tell you that these are just not an effective device in terms of having a big impact. Now, the organizations that are victim to fraud, of course, their worst, their biggest vulnerability is the fact that they have they may have no clearly established controls in place at all. So that's part of, you know, why we're out here, just trying to remind people to really look at those things. You know, a lot of smaller nonprofits might feel that they just don't have the resources to invest in, you know, the less interesting parts of their mission. But if you want to have a strong reputation, you have to be known as a good steward of your resources.
Sure.
And that
yeah.
starts with fraud prevention. Now, in terms of check fraud, can I go on to that?
Yeah, okay. we will, for sure. But let's talk a little more about this internal audit that you're saying is much more reliable. Where would we look, again, to board members to conduct an internal audit? Is that appropriate?
Well, say, for example, in your payments process, you wouldn't have the person who is submitting invoices or approving them for payment writing the checks. Or you wouldn't have the person who writes the check reconciling the accounts, because you need someone to catch someone else's error or impropriety. In the same regard to internal audits, you just want to have someone who's outside of a particular function, just confirming that those functions are being performed up to standard. So it doesn't have to be a big organized effort. It might just be, you know, someone going and checking to make sure someone has locked up the check stock so that it can't be stolen and misused.
Okay. All right. So someone outside the function mm-hmm. is looking at it. Mm-hmm. And it could be another employee.
Exactly. I mean, a supervisor is perfect for that kind of thing.
Okay. All right. So let's move to check fraud.
Okay.
How do we, I guess the vulnerability is pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. People are writing checks that they shouldn't be either to themselves or maybe they're overpaying a vendor that they have a relationship with. Are there other types of fraud that we should be, before we get into how to prevent it?
Oh, sure. Well, so check fraud centers around three main areas, and then there's a fourth area that's just simply created by a weakness in the commercial code. So checks are vulnerable to alteration, where the payee name or the amount gets modified. I think a really simple way to prevent that would be to ensure that you don't leave blank spaces, you know, next to a name or before a number. So just simply putting asterisks before your number so the entire field is filled.
So no one
can slip a one comma or a five comma, whatever, in front of your number, or change the name of the vendor. Another area where they're vulnerable is with tampering, where a check could be, say, dipped in a chemical bath that would wipe out the ink, and then a criminal or a fraudster could modify what's on the face of the check.
Okay, can I ask you about that one?
Sure.
I once attended a seminar by Frank Abagnale.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you do. Have you ever met him?
No, I haven't met him, but I'm very familiar with his work.
He's huge in fraud protection.
Yes.
He recommended a particular... I implemented a bunch of things. I got a micro dot shredder mm-hmm. because he made it clear how insecure even the cross-cut shredders are. Mm-hmm. So I have it in my office. The things are shredded into little like paper bullets that you can't unravel or something.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
So I did, and then
it can't be shipped off to a sweatshop where someone who makes pennies a day can put it back together.
For hundreds of hours of labor, can put it back together. And another suggestion was he has this certain type of pen, which now I think his name is on, where the ink bleeds into the paper mm-hmm. so that it can't be washed in the way you're describing.
Exactly.
Does that work?
Or yes.
Am I being bilked?
No, it works well and it's commonly available.
Okay.
So you will see most stationery supply sections of any office supply store include pens that fight that check washing. We also make some available in our own catalog, but they're easily available.
Okay. Now, what if you are printing your checks on a printer? How do you prevent this acid wash bath from removing the ink that way?
Well,
From removing that ink.
Well, people in general in the industry talk about fraud protection as a kind of arms race, right? There's a determined fraudster will, with the right tools, you know, will do everything they can to defeat the protections you have in place. So, for example, different kinds of check stock will fight or be resilient to other various kinds of fraud.
Check stock meaning the paper?
The paper itself.
Okay.
Right. So, for example, when I first started in this role, we were selling a check stock that was advertised that it was resilient to chemical washing. But then when we moved to offering a high-security check stock, it was protected against a much wider variety of chemicals. So let me step back a little bit. So when we were talking about the vulnerabilities of checks,
yes.
They're vulnerable to alteration. They're vulnerable to tampering. And they're also vulnerable to counterfeiting. And counterfeit checks are actually the most commonly passed ones when check fraud happens. And they can be counterfeited in a number of ways. One way is that the check is simply, the fraudster has gotten hold of your account information. Maybe they legitimately received a check, or they've stolen one from your trash, or from your office, which is why it's such an important requirement to have your checks locked up. Or they have simply made a copy of one of your checks and then altered the information on the copy. So, and because access to the technology to copy checks is so prevalent now, that's a real area of vulnerability. On our earlier version of our checks, for example, if it were color copied, the word void would appear on the copy.
Okay.
But then newer, that wouldn't show up with newer copy machines because the technology had evolved in such a way that it didn't trigger the same fraud protection in the paper. So that's an example of, you know, why technologies have emerged to create more high security checks. And then a final area of vulnerability, which is one that Mr. Abagnale likes to talk about. It has to do with HDIC claims, which is their holder in due course claims. Which
holder in due course?
Right, which is a portion
of... I have jargon jail on the show. And
I know, I'm
sorry. I'd
hate
to put you in. How do you know?
So
you must have heard me say it to somebody else. Put somebody else in jargon jail.
Well, let me explain what it is.
Okay, that's the way to get yourself on parole, yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. You can... I will just apologize right here and explain
really
quickly.
You talk like a lawyer. Holder in due course.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
Have you ever considered consulting a roadmap when you feel you need help getting to your destination? When the normal path seems blocked, a little help can come in handy when choosing an alternate route. Your natal chart is a map of your potentials. It addresses relationships, finance, business, health, and above all, creativity. Current planetary cycles can either support or challenge your objectives. I'm Montgomery Taylor. If you would like to explore the help of a private astrological reading, please contact me at Monty@MontyTaylor.com. That's Monty, M-O-N-T-Y, @MontyTaylor.com.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Anyway, a holder in due course is basically it's a function of our commercial code that privileges the needs of the banking system that unfortunately sacrifices the protections that account holders have out of meeting the requirements of the banking system to simply function.
Okay.
So this legal term, holder in due course, means anyone who accepts payment of a check. Let's see, they have to accept the payment in good faith. And the device, the check itself, can not appear to be suspicious in any way, so it looks reasonably correct. But that's the main function, that you accept a check in good faith and that you cash it. So normally that's a bank, but it could also be the corner market who cashes your paycheck and lets you buy groceries. It could also be a check cashing service who then takes the check and presents it. And what's...
Could also be, in terms of your accepting checks, mm-hmm. could also be a nonprofit that processes a charitable gift.
Absolutely.
Okay. Those are all holders in due course.
Yes.
Okay.
So what's important about this function, this particular legal situation, is that it creates a special vulnerability of check fraud. One reason is that checks don't expire as quickly as we think that they do. A check is good for 10 years after its issuance date. If it has been refused by your bank, bounced in other words, it is still good for 3 years from the date that it was rejected. So for example, a stop payment doesn't necessarily protect you from a holder in due course claim. So Mr. Abagnale has really done a great job of talking about this, and the commercial law classes always cover these a couple of these cases, one of which is an organization issued a paycheck to an employee. That person claimed that they'd lost the check and requested a replacement. So the company put a stop payment on the check and issued a replacement check. And then that person went and took the original check and tried to cash it at a corner store. That store cashed the check, and then the bank returned it and didn't pay the check and said, this is a bad check.
Yeah.
So the store owner just posted it on their wall to remind themselves not to ever cash anybody else's check. And then a gentleman named Robert Triffin, who makes a business of buying bad checks, purchased the check for like pennies on the dollar and sued for a holder in due course claim. And he won the claim because even though the company had put a stop payment on the check, it looked like a valid financial instrument, and it was, and the court deemed it was valid. There was nothing on the face of the check to tell them, and that outstripped the stop payment claim. Now, that could have been easily avoided if the the company had printed the words void after 60 days, 90 days, and not issued a replacement until after it had expired. But because they hadn't done that, they had no protections, and they were vulnerable for the entire period that that check was a valid instrument, which was 10 years. Or it's not commonly known.
No, for sure. So yeah. So the lesson is, you put this, is it called a disclaimer or
you put an expiration date on the front of your checks.
Okay.
Now, I work with a manufacturer that's one of the biggest financial printers in this country. In fact, they serve on, you know, the Federal Reserve Board and contribute to, you know, our...
You serve on the Federal Reserve Board?
Our manufacturer does.
Oh, manufacturer. Okay.
So I asked them, I said, so how many people print expirations on their checks? And they said less than 5%.
Oh, boy.
So it's an enormous amount of vulnerability that we could easily manage.
Okay.
And then I'll move on real quickly. So there's another form of...
That's okay. Well, we have a little time.
Yeah?
I'm still interested in the stock. When you're buying check stock from a printer, what is it you need to...
Pay attention
ask for
to?
Yeah. What do you got to make sure you're buying?
Well, I'm glad you asked that.
Okay. Cool.
So,
I'm thrilled myself. I was pretty impressed myself. Go ahead.
So the features you care about are on your check stock. The most important ones are ones that will survive copying. So say someone makes a color copy of your check. You want a feature on there that it makes it evident that this is not an authentic original. So you want the original qualities of the check to jump off the page. For example, our high security check stock has thermochromatic ink, which means there's a little lock symbol on the bottom of the check. It's bright pink. It's a fuchsia color. But if you breathe on it, you know, if your breath is hot, the color drains out of the image. And that tells you that it's an original document. So if someone had made a Xerox copy of it and passed it, that's too expensive a feature to duplicate. So it describes it.
Thermochromatic ink is one
element.
One thing you should be looking for?
Right.
What else?
Another thing would be a warning banner on the front of the check that says, this check has a number of security features which would be listed on the back. And please take the trouble to confirm that you have an authentic check in your hands. Another example I used in my talk is a really famous one covered in the case law. The most important forms of vulnerability to HDIC claims is that even a counterfeit check is considered...
It's got to be HIDC, isn't it?
Holder
in due course, HIDC?
But it's definitely HDIC.
It is? So, okay, then I'm wrong. All right.
For the category of claims.
Okay.
So the other one that's really important is
talking about
that,
the paper now still,
yes,
right? Okay.
Why it matters to have high security stock in general. All right, let me back up and tell you another story that had to do with other bad checks that Mr. Triffin bought.
Okay.
So in the case of Somerset Valley Bank, an employer had outsourced their payroll to a payroll processing company, and they printed on a certain kind of check stock, and they signed all the checks with a signature stamp that had red and green ink. It was very distinctive. And someone managed to create a bunch of counterfeit checks that looked exactly like the check stock that this individual used, and they used the same signature stamp or an identical signature stamp. And they passed off, I don't know, thousands and thousands of dollars of them. The bank and the account holder became aware of it. So as the checks came in, the bank marked the checks, you know, basically stolen check, do not present again, don't honor this check, and returned $8,000 worth almost to a particular check cashing service, which our friend Mr. Triffin purchased, and then sued for HDIC claims. He won that particular suit because there was nothing on the face of the check to indicate that it was counterfeited. So they were good enough copies to be considered valid instruments.
Yeah.
Even though when he purchased them, they were marked essentially, these are stolen checks. The court still ruled it in his favor, and he was paid the money.
I love this guy, Triffin, is like a deep, deep expert on...
He's found a loophole, and he works
course
it.
Claims. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But he lost another important case because the check stock in question at that point had the words, this is high security check stock, and the warning banner said, please look for the following features on the back of the check.
Yeah.
And they weren't on the color copy. They didn't survive duplication. So a simple use of high security check stock prevents those claims from happening and can limit your liability.
Okay.
So I've talked here about certain processes or tools you can use to protect yourself from fraud.
Right.
A really important other component of this is the fact that your bank decides for you, for the account holder, what ordinary care should consist of. And ordinary care is another legal term, which basically says this is what a reasonable person in the same circumstances would do to protect their own interests. Failure to exercise ordinary care is negligence in the face of the law. The important thing about thinking about the UCC code and the reason all these things come up is there was a time when fraud occurred against an account holder before 1993 when the bank was responsible or liable for those fraud claims. So if they allowed a bad check to be cashed, the bank was responsible. That's not true anymore.
Yeah.
And in fact, in the Federal Reserve Board survey, banks...
Why am I not surprised that that's changed?
Yes. Financial institutions don't list check fraud as their biggest form of vulnerability. They're much more vulnerable to credit card fraud, where our protections are higher. But for check fraud, it's the account holders who are increasingly and have been more and more responsible and damaged by check fraud losses. So that's another point. You know, it's really important to stress for nonprofits looking at their arrangements. So not only do you want to make...
Well, looking at their arrangement with their bank and what that bank constitutes as
make sure
ordinary,
you know what your bank's
care.
Standards are with respect to your account security and your relationship to them.
If you don't live up to it, your bank is going to turn on you, basically, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And not only is it important to know what their standards are, but know how your liabilities are defined in your contract.
Okay.
Okay.
We have just about a minute and a half or so left.
Okay.
Why don't you... this is such an interesting, deep niche that you've got.
I know.
I love it. It's critical. Tell me what you love about the work that you're doing.
Oh, well, first of all, I work for a company. I think all of us employees for Blackbaud say this kind of thing, so it feels kind of goofy to say, but we're so energized by the missions of the clients that we work with. It's just the happiest thing to help people be successful in this.
How about on that personal level?
Well, for me, it's, you know, being a good steward of your resources is critical. You know, nonprofits are so often judged, the judgment of them is reduced to one simple idea, which is what percentage of your resources have gone to the administration of this charity, and how much else is left for your mission. I mean, I think it's a really unfair standard, but to the extent that that is how the public judges charities and nonprofits, it's really important to make sure that people are empowered to use the tools to protect their interests and limit their liabilities as much as possible. So it's like my small way of helping people do their best. And that's a nice thing to know you can do.
Thank you very much, Melanie.
Oh, you're welcome, Tony.
Terrific.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Melanie Morton is the manager of Blackboard Forms, and you're listening to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of BBCon 2013.
Thanks very much again to the people at BBCon and to Melanie Morton and also to Kelly Jarrett. Next week, when leaders leave, I hope, I'm pretty close to confirming that author Priscilla Rosenwald is going to talk next week about her book, When Leaders Leave, and share her strategies for planning leadership transitions. Keep your fingers crossed. Rallybound is a sponsor. They make it easy to use software for runs, walks, and rides. They're a Giving Tuesday partner. We talked about Giving Tuesday last week. So if you're thinking of participating in Giving Tuesday, you want to know that they have a Giving Tuesday campaign that they're offering for free. You would go to rallybound.com/Giving Tuesday. I have met the CEO of Rallybound, Shmuley Pinson. He's a very good guy. Their software is very smart. And Joe McGee, who will help you set up your account, is very easy to work with. I've had a lot of conversations with him as well. And he'll do everything that he can to help you set up your campaign. This is peer-to-peer fundraising. There's support for your office, as well as for all the people who are asking their friends to give to your campaign. You can claim a discount as a nonprofit listener. Go to rallybound.com or call them and talk to Joe McGee. 888-767-9076. 888-767-9076. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is our line producer. The show's social media is by Deborah Askenaze of Community Organizer 2.0. And the remote producer of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio is John Federico of The New Rules. Our music is by Scott Stein. Oh, I hope you'll be with me next Friday, 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern, at Talking Alternative Broadcasting at talkingalternative.com.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you a female entrepreneur ready to break through? Join us at Sexy Body, Sassy Soul, where women are empowered to ask for and receive what they truly want in love, life, and business. Tune in Thursdays at noon Eastern Time to learn tips and juicy secrets from inspiring women and men who dare to define their success. Get inspired, stay motivated, and define your version of joy and success with Sexy Body, Sassy Soul, every Thursday at noon New York Time on TalkingAlternative.com.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
This is Tony Martinetti, the aptly named host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Technology, fundraising, compliance, social media. Small and medium nonprofits have needs in all these areas. My guests are expert in all these areas and more. Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, Fridays, 1 to 2 Eastern on Talking Alternative Broadcasting.
Are you concerned about the future of your business or career? Would you like it all to just be better? Well, the way to do that is through better communication. And the best way to do that is training from the team at Improving Communications. This is Larry Sharp, host of the Ivory Tower Radio Program and director at Improving Communications. Does your office need better leadership, customer service, sales, or maybe better writing or speaking skills? Could they be better at dealing with confrontation, conflicts, and touchy subjects? All are covered here at Improving Communications. If you're in the New York City area, stop by one of our public classes or get your human resources in touch with us. The website is improvingcommunications.com. That's improvingcommunications.com. Improve your professional environment. Be more effective. Be happier and make more money. Improving communications. That's the answer.
TalkingAlternative.com.